Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
Welcome to a special edition of Scientifica with Hugh Ross and Fuzz Rana, who have returned from ISAL 2017, and we have assembled other members of the team here at RTB. We have a true roundtable discussion here. AJ Roberts joins us as well, and Dave Rogstad, who you also hear on Ken Sample's podcast. Guys, just to get some business out of the way, ISAL 2017 is the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life, held this year in San Diego. This was July 16th through the 21st. And you both attended, you both being Hugh and Fuzz, and you wanted to share some insights from the conference. First of all, hello to everybody around the table.
Hello.
Can we
Hi
get
Joe.
A
yeah.
hello?
Hello.
Greetings,
right.
everybody.
We are all here, and we're going to have a lively discussion, some back and forth, and I'm sure our listeners are eager to hear from Hugh and Fuzz in particular, and there's going to be some good interaction regarding what you gathered from that conference. Before we proceed, let's remind listeners who might be hearing this term for the first time, what's ISAL 2017? We'll abbreviate it that way, but let's hear from you guys what that conference is all about, the purpose, how long it's been in existence, why you even attended. Why send a couple of scholars down to San Diego, besides the beautiful beaches, right, guys?
Yeah, that's right. And it was Comic-Con last week, too.
Oh, yeah.
So Hugh and I were hanging out.
No, the real reason.
Yeah.
What was your costume, Buzz?
Hey, I don't need a costume. But the International Society for the Study of Origin of Life is the professional organization that essentially attracts origin of life researchers. So it would be similar to something like the American Chemical Society or the American Physical Society, professional organizations that attract chemists and physicists respectively. And every 3 years, this society hosts an international conference on the origin of life. This is the 18th conference that just happened this past week, where it attracts the premier origin of life researchers from around the world.
A veritable who's who.
Yes, yeah. If you want to know who really is doing the most important work in origin of life research, they are going to be at this conference presenting the latest work that comes from their laboratories.
All right. And it happened to be in San Diego, so it made sense for the two of you to go down. You didn't have to go to a foreign country, for
well,
example.
This yeah. is the third time we've gone to such a conference, and our policy is if it's in North America, we'll go. If it's in some place that's going to cost the ministry a ton of money, like China or India, we don't go.
All right.
Yeah, and we went to the conference in 1999, which was actually also at UC San Diego. So this was a little bit of completing the circle, so to speak. One of the first things that I did when I started with the ministry, I started in middle of June 1999, was one of the first things I did was go down to UC San Diego to this Origin of Life conference, which was a great way to kickstart the work that I do currently in Origin of Life research. And in 2002, Hugh and I attended Oaxaca, the conference in Oaxaca, Mexico. And those two conferences and what we learned at those conferences formed the framework for our book, Origins of Life. And given that it's been 15 years since we've been at this conference and since it was in our backyard, we felt like it was worth attending just to see where are things at today, 15 years later.
Terrific. Okay, well, we're going to get to a lot of that as we go. How many people attended this time and compared to how it's been over the years?
257. We went in 1999. There was about 400.
Wow.
We were at the one in Mexico. It was a little more than 300. This one's 257. And I was interested in, you know, what was different about the attendees. And what I noticed, what's quite different, is that this conference was dominated by astrobiologists. So like the two previous conferences were dominated by chemists, this one astronomers were predominant. And also what I notice is the degree to which NASA is kind of the elephant in the room. Most of the people there were there because they were on a NASA-type grant. So NASA, I think, is really interested in the origin of life, and, you know, they were one of the actual sponsors for this event. And of those 257, I think at least half were students. They had some senior undergrads there, graduate students, and some postdoctoral fellows. And so the top-line origin of life researchers, probably about 100 of the 257 would be in that category. And that's something that Fuzz and I have commented on before. In terms of people dedicating their life to serious origin of life research, the numbers are declining as time goes on. And I think there's reasons for why we're observing that decline.
Yeah, and in addition to NASA, the European Space Agency is also a primary funder of origin of life research. It's, as Hugh's mentioning, it's intertwined with astrobiology. I would say that I actually saw a lot of people who I would identify as chemists and biochemists there as well. So it was an interesting mix of people. There was a lot more young people, I think, at this year's conference than in previous conferences we attended. One of the things that's interesting that's been a development that I think is also responsible for attracting a younger demographic to this area is that at one time it wasn't really a wise thing to go into origin of life research as a career path because there was so little funding for it. And of course, this has changed now because of the astrobiology programs that NASA and the European Space Agency and other groups are interested in funding. So there is money for young people to go into this work, but we're also seeing the emergence of something called synthetic biology as a discipline in biology, where one of the goals of that research program is to create artificial cells in the lab, where people are starting with chemicals and trying to create chemical super systems that would resemble a cell. They're trying to make protocells, and that activity is reminiscent of what origin of life researchers do, where they try to mimic the process of life coming from chemical systems, trying to recapitulate the origin of life. And because of that, a lot of the work that's done in synthetic biology has implications for the origin of life and vice versa. So people, as young scientists that are trained in origin of life research in prebiotic chemistry, actually have career options outside of origin of life research in synthetic biology. And you definitely saw that synthetic biology component in the last couple of days of the conference, where the work that was being presented was dominated by synthetic biology type research projects.
Okay. We're going to get into the meat of it now, and I want to hear what some of the presenters had to say.
Just a quickie question. Do the people like the SETI type people come to these conferences too?
There were a few SETI people there. Okay. that had affiliations with the SETI Institute.
Okay. Yeah. I want to hear what some of the presentations were. I don't know if they're called poster presentations or plenary sessions, or what the nature of the...
It's a rather small and intimate conference. So there was a number of presentations that were made to the entire conference.
Yeah.
So there were plenary talks each morning and each afternoon, and then shorter, you know, talks that were describing specific experimental work. There were posters that were up throughout the course of the conference that people could read, and there were times where the authors of the posters were at their posters where there could be conversations that took place. There were panel sessions where they would have a team of panelists discussing a particular question in the origin of life that would include audience participation. So it was a combination of plenary talks, shorter presentations of research, posters, and panels. Mm.
Okay. But like the previous conferences, they were topically oriented. So like on a particular morning, all the papers presented were in one particular subdiscipline. So you got to hear a subdiscipline at every different session.
Okay.
And so they began with the astrobiology and then moved into the chemistry.
Yeah.
So the flow was, you know, what is the prospect of discovering life on other planets? To can prebiotic materials be delivered to early Earth through comets and meteorites and interplanetary dust particles to what are the conditions of the early Earth, when did life appear on early Earth, what role do minerals play in the origin of life, what are some interesting new insights into prebiotic chemistry, how do building blocks get made, how do those building blocks assemble into polymers, how do those polymers evolve to have self-replicating properties, how do compartments form, and how does then the replicating materials in the compartments integrate into protocells, and then what does the very first life form look like on Earth? So you went from really the cosmos to LUCA, with each step, each day representing different steps in that process towards complexity. Mm,
okay. We'll hear your analysis of that, and I'm sure AJ and Dave will have a lot of questions as well. But again, for benefit of lay people,
for benefit of lay people, just back up and say what LUCA is. I know it's a familiar term.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's the last universal common ancestor. It's believed to either be the cell or the community of cells that anchor the evolutionary tree of life. So if you think of the history of life from an evolutionary perspective as existing in two stages, one would be the origin of life, which culminates in LUCA, and the next stage would be biological evolution, which begins with LUCA and culminates with human beings. And so LUCA is kind of that transition from chemical evolution to biological evolution, or from origin of life to, again, biological evolution.
Okay. Where are we in terms of the origin of life research for benefit of lay people? Those of us who hearken back to our high school or maybe even college biology or chemistry might remember the Miller-Urey experiments, for example. What was that, 1953 or 51?
Yes. 53, yeah. Yes.
Maybe that's all we remember for benefit of lay people. Is that like the starting point of all this, or are we way past that and on to other things now? Help lay people get up to speed, and where did it start for the conference, and where are we at, and where did the presentation
begin? Yeah, the Miller-Urey discussion of the Miller-Urey type experiments was more in the middle portion of the conference. So
okay.
It was quite a bit of discussion of events that would have preceded the assembly of prebiotic materials into building blocks, which is what the Miller-Urey experiment involved, was the production of amino acids from prebiotic materials.
Yeah, way more attention was given on the Urey-Miller experiment than previous conferences. And Fuzz, what I observed is they were trying to look at the conditions of the Earth hundreds of millions of years before the origin of life, where they thought they might have a hope for the reducing chemicals that are critical to make that experiment work. But that raises a whole point. Is it even possible that you could have the origin of life that early in the history? And one of the astronomers got up and made the point, look, if you try to make it that early, that's a time when the sun is pouring out very damaging ultraviolet radiation at a very high abundance level. And not just that, but X-rays, and you've got these huge dangerous flaring events, basically making the point, I know you need to get that early to get the chemistry you're looking for, and even then, it's a hopeful chemistry, but then you're so early that you got problems with the solar radiation.
Yeah, I think it's really important to point out to people that origin of life researchers universally acknowledge that the Miller-Urey experiment is irrelevant to the origin of life, because the conditions that Miller used in his prebiotic simulation studies were not the conditions that we now believe to exist on the early Earth. And when you employ those conditions, they're just simply nothing that happens in a Miller-Urey experiment, where Miller envisioned the atmosphere being comprised of gases in which high-energy discharges to the atmosphere would generate prebiotic materials that would then react to form amino acids and other interesting compounds like alpha-hydroxy acids and so on and so forth. And so the atmosphere that Miller chose for his experiments was what we thought to be the atmosphere in the 1950s, but it turns out that we later discover that the atmosphere is very different. And so that chemistry that Miller discovered is irrelevant to the origin of life. But to me, maybe the highlight of the conference was a Wednesday evening panel discussion where the question was, 64 years after the Miller-Urey experiment, have we solved the building block problem? And it was a veritable who's who of Origin of Life researchers. Jack Szostak, a Nobel laureate, who's doing a lot of work in his lab at Harvard University, looking at the generation of self-replicating RNA molecules and the production of self-replicating vesicles. There's Donna Blackmon, who is one of the world's leading experts on the origin of homo chirality. You had Steve Benner, who's at the University of Florida, who's doing work in generating alternative genetic systems to RNA and DNA, and then a guy named Nicholas Hudd. And the chairman of that session was Antonio Lascano, who was a longtime friend of Stanley Miller, who died in 2008. And Lascano is a very well-known Origin of Life researcher himself. And he opened up the session by giving a retrospective on the Miller-Urey experiment, which was rather interesting and quite charming. But he made a really interesting point in which he said, a month before Miller published his paper in Science reporting the results of his study, Watson and Crick published the structure of DNA. So when Miller did his experiments, we didn't even know what the structure of DNA was. And so that's, you know, really fascinating. But it's interesting, 64 years later, we're on the cusp of this CRISPR-Cas9 revolution in molecular biology that AJ is so well versed in. Yet when it comes to origin of life research, the panelists universally concluded we have no explanation for where building block materials come from. It's an unsolved problem. And Steve Benner even said, I even beginning to wonder if we know where prebiotic compounds came from. And so it's interesting how the disciplines really are a contrast in progress, where one is leading to a succession of revolutions over the last, 50 plus years, 60 years almost, and the other is basically one where there's not really any kind of genuine progress happening. So it's a real contrast in progress. But what people uniformly will say is that the Miller-Urey experiment, though irrelevant, is very important to the origin of life because it's the experiment that kicked off the discipline, that turned it into an experimental discipline and set the pace for what people do even today. So it's a very important experiment, though irrelevant to the origin of life.
Yeah, I would agree with Fuzz that evening panel was kind of the highlight of the conference. The exact question that was posed to the panel, can the formation of building blocks of life be considered as salt? And all four panelists, plus the moderator, said no. I remember Jack Szostak got up and he made the comment, not only is the building blocks problem not solved, the building blocks of the building blocks isn't even solved. And he mentioned even things like hydrogen cyanide, which is, that's just HCN. He said, we have issues trying to come up with adequate quantities of HCN under the early Earth conditions. So he says, yeah, we're in huge trouble.
So I know that the atmosphere being not reducing and closer to a neutral atmosphere is sort of the current view of the early Earth atmosphere, but that's pushed some people into sort of microclimes to try and explain the origin of life, like volcanoes or deep sea vents. Were there any comments on that?
Yes.
Yeah, there were, but, this was maybe one of the bigger differences between 2002 and this year, was there didn't seem to be as much discussion of hydrothermal vent environments as I've seen in the past, or volcanic emissions. More attention seemed to be paid to cometary delivery and
right. And
interplanetary dust particles and meteorites as being delivery mechanisms for prebiotics.
So that would be a sort of modified version or an extended version of the panspermia theory, where you're delivering prebiotics and the majority of those are coming from interstellar planetary bodies.
But that's how I read the consensus. We're not going to make it work on Earth. These things have to come from outer space. And it was interstellar molecular clouds and comets.
But the appeal to these alternate environments is a reflection of the fact that the atmospheric models for prebiotics have utterly failed. And so these are alternatives, but each alternative in and of itself is riddled with a whole ensemble of problems. One of the things that was also really interesting was the idea that maybe life originated in these warm little freshwater ponds on volcanic islands on the early Earth. And but the problem with that, and the reason why people are going down that path, is because we know that salt will actually inhibit a lot of the chemistry you need for vesicle formation, for RNA assembly on clays, and yada, 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 yada. So they're appealing to these
freshwater
environments that would be produced by evaporation and rainfall on the early Earth. The
problem, and small, because they need the condensation and a drying and rehydration, and exactly. They need that cycling, phase cycling.
Repeated wetting and drying to get the concentration, because that's the problem is they're dealing with such dilute amounts of the building blocks they need. They're trying to come up with some way to concentrate it.
Right. And the cycling between evaporation and rehydration actually serves as an energy source to drive the chemistry as well. But the problem is nobody knows how to get the prebiotics into those warm little ponds, so to speak. But again, it was one of the hotter topics at the conference, though I don't think it was compelling that this was actually a solution to the origin of life.
Well, we got another problem is that if you're looking for freshwater sources, you got to have land masses, which means you now have the origin of life happening, you know, like 3.8 billion years ago, as opposed to really early, where they speculate the chemistry might be different. But I didn't really hear any discussion about the dating of the tectonics that's necessary to get these warm ponds. And I kept thinking, you know, that's really a huge problem for this whole scenario, because we've got a really good date as to when these continental land masses begin to form.
So this might be a little bit of a naive question, but, you know, certainly as a microbiologist, we know that Earth is riddled with extremophiles. And yet, is there much being done sort of in extreme environments as an origin of life possible scenario, or is it that extreme environments make the chemistry even more difficult?
I think the sense is that extreme environments makes the chemistry more difficult. Now, it's true in extreme environments you can get some really interesting chemistry happening that, you know, producing prebiotic-type materials and even things that begin to approach building block-type materials. But those conditions are usually so harsh that what winds up forming gets destroyed right away, or it gets spewed into the oceans and becomes highly dilute in the ocean environment. So those are some of the problems that...
Well, AJ, back in 2002, there was a lot of attention on extremophiles. But what happened 3 years later, 4 years later, in the journal Astrobiology, a paper got published saying extremophiles are irrelevant to the origin of life, basically making Fuzz's point. These creatures are, you know, they're basically all repair mechanisms.
Yeah.
And the complexity of these things is orders of magnitude
because
beyond.
They have to have redundancies and things like that.
They got to have all that built in, so it just makes the origin of life problem orders of magnitude more challenging.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting that represents a sharp distinction between 2002 and this year was in 2002, people were heavily debating actually when did life appear on Earth. Because at that time, there was evidence that suggested life appeared on Earth at 3.8 billion years ago, or maybe even at 3.5 billion years ago. But all that evidence was disputed as being disputed in terms of being bioauthentic, where people are arguing maybe there are abiotic processes that could produce it. This year, I think uniformly everybody was saying life's appearing at 3.8 billion years ago, and that these first life forms consisted of these stromatolite communities, which are complex ecosystems, and they were photoautotrophic near the surface of the Earth. And in fact, there was even suggestion that maybe life appeared at 4.1 billion years ago.
Because of the carbon trapped in zircon crystals, that data? Or
Right. And there's also evidence of microtubules in rocks recovered in Quebec at 4.1 billion years. And those microtubules would be a signature for life. So,
and is that data well accepted, or is that still somewhat controversial?
It's controversial.
It's disputed.
But to me, the fact that there's that consensus now says you really have got a real constraint on the origin of life, where it's got to happen very quickly in order for it to appear that early in Earth's history.
Especially with you got the late heavy bombardment at 3.87. Because, I mean, that's going to be a sterilization event, and yet what you have very soon thereafter.
Well, so the sterilization event raises another question, which is that maybe there were multiple origins of life. I've read that, right? And that there wasn't just a LUCA or even a conglomeration of cells,
AJ,
but maybe multiple.
That's the reason we put on our book Origins of Life, because we wanted to leave the door open for the possibility that maybe God had several origins of life. And the rationale behind that, what if he needs to jumpstart the chemistry? And, you know, that's still an unanswered question. Maybe he doesn't, maybe he does. Yeah. I think what's brought some clarity to that is now we got a decent date for the onset of plate tectonics. And it really does appear that the origin of life and tectonics need to be simultaneous events.
You know, one of the things that argues against a naturalistic scenario where there's multiple origin of life is the universal nature of biochemistry. That suggests there's either a single or, well, there could be multiple origins of life, but what we're looking at is that last event where everything is descended from a naturalistic perspective from that last organism, or there are multiple origin of life events where there was a fusion of these separate organisms into a singular organism that then bears that universal imprint for all of biochemical, or that universal biochemistry that is evident in all organisms. So that universal nature of biochemistry, I think, constrains the kind of models that would be possible from a naturalistic perspective for multiple origin of life events.
Unless there's something within biochemistry itself that constrains life to be of a certain nature, and that they all end up being so close that...
That's actually my opinion, that that's a whole nother topic,
right.
But I'm actually of the opinion that the biochemistry we see in life is actually...
fairly constrained.
By the laws of nature, and that it's part of the design that we see in life is it's like an anthropic principle for biochemistry. Right. But that's a side point.
Well, that's a change in my perspective personally, because back in 2000, I was thinking, well, I can see some rationale for God wanting to have multiple origins of life. But based on what we learned about the geophysical history of the Earth, I'm leaning towards, no, it's a single event. Roughly 3.8 billion years ago.
But as we think about the different kingdoms of life, we don't think of a single origin. We think of nodal origins and multiple ones. So that's kind of part of what was behind my question.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a possibility, and you seem to be driven there because of the history of the early Earth, where there are these catastrophic events that would be sterilization or near sterilization events that would be frustration events. So you're driven by that to posit multiple origin of life scenarios. But
I have a question backing up a little bit. One of the approaches that people are taking is that they're hoping that somehow prebiotic material will be delivered to the Earth. It just, you know, without thinking about it a whole lot, why would it be any simpler to make that stuff somewhere else than here, which we would tend to think is a much more benign environment for making these kinds of...
And when they're talking about prebiotic material, they're talking about things like formaldehyde, hydrogen cyanide, methane, carbon monoxide. Those are the kinds of materials they're talking about being delivered, at least in comets.
Okay.
And so you're not looking at the building blocks themselves being delivered.
It's just some raw material.
But the raw material, because that's, as Steve Benner points out, that actually is a real problem, is we don't really know even where those kind of materials would have come from.
Here on Earth.
Yes.
But you can see them when you look through radio telescopes or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we've actually sent a spacecraft. I think the European Space Agency sent a spacecraft to a particular comet and actually got some measurements of something. And the comet actually bounced, or the spacecraft bounced off the surface.
Right. But the Wild 2 comet.
Yeah, but in the process of bouncing off of it,
they were able to get some data
of who knows exactly what, but of something.
Well, they did find some simple amino acids, and part of what's driving it too, Dave, is that you got a problem trying to come up with a reducing environment on the early Earth. But they're saying we go to an interstellar molecular cloud, maybe that's where we can have the required reducing environment. But there's data showing you don't get very much ammonia in those clouds.
So was there a summary of which amino acids and which sort of bases for nucleic acids that they've actually been able to find the precursors for in interstellar materials?
They have found one nucleobase base in a comet. And comets and meteorites. They got a nucleobase, and they have found six amino acids. But the six amino acids... Biological amino acids, although isovaline, which is not a biological amino acid, is much more abundant. The abundant ones are isovaline and glycine. They've not found any of the complex bioactive amino acids. They're missing.
Now, the way a chemist would think about this, though, is...
They're precursors.
That if you have hydrogen cyanide, if you have formaldehyde, if you have ammonia and methane, you've got
the precursors,
the ingredients, so that if that's delivered to Earth, those are what you need to build all the nucleobases and a significant number of the amino acids.
But if you're starting with that, don't you need high energy or high temperature in order to give you the chemistry that you need?
Not necessarily. Okay. Not for all the reactions. And something that is interesting is there's been some experiments done in the lab showing that if you shock those kind of systems, that you not only are destroying things, but you're creating molecular fragments that recombine and actually can create molecular complexity.
Right.
And so, it may be that the delivery to Earth may have actually been critical in triggering the prebiotic reactions.
Yeah, support for that, they've not found any amino acids or nucleobases in the interstellar molecular clouds. And however, when a meteorite crashes into the Earth, you get a shock inducement that seems to be responsible for making the few amino acids in the one nucleobase they have found. But again, we're talking parts per million or less. So very dilute.
Yeah, that's the quantities that you're delivering are so low.
The concentration becomes a huge issue.
And another thing as well is that we know that these extraterrestrial sources of organics or prebiotic materials would be enriched in deuterium and carbon 13, and we don't see deuterium and carbon 13 enrichments in the organic materials in the oldest rocks on Earth. We see actually carbon 12 enrichment and hydrogen 1 enrichment, which argues against this extraterrestrial delivery process.
There are a couple more things I want to ask you, not that we have to stop this discussion, but before too much time gets away, is your personal interactions with people and some other impressions that you had, and also what you think the future of this conference is, whether that was articulated by the drivers of the conference or what you think the future is for ISOL.
Well, one thing I saw, Joe, I think this is a direct outset of NASA and ESA funding, is the emphasis on planets, exoplanets. I mean, almost 2 days of discussion were focused on those planets. And what I saw that was different from the chemistry, and maybe you can comment on this, Fuzz, is the chemistry, there's been some amazing advances in what they've been able to do in the lab, kind of what you've already pointed out in your book, Creating Life in the Lab. And I was really impressed how much progress they've made since 2002 in that area. And yet they're pessimistic about, trying to solve the chemical problems. I saw the reverse in the astronomy area, where everything we're discussing should make you pessimistic, but they're incredibly optimistic. I mean, I think you can remember, Fuzz, one speaker got up and says, TRAPPIST-1 is the best thing that's happened to us. These seven planets we've seen orbiting this very cool M-dwarf star. And it's like, I can't believe what I'm hearing. It's like TRAPPIST-1 is probably the worst place to try to find conditions, conducive to life.
Both you and Jeff reported on that this past year.
Right, and that literature is, even in the past few weeks, is basically saying, forget any kind of M-dwarf star.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's driving the enthusiasm, we're finding that the vast majority of planets that we're discovering are orbiting M-dwarf stars. And for people not familiar with that term, that refers to the smallest mass stars, which literally make up 80% of all the stars that exist in the universe. But something I'm going to report on in the next Scientifica that we have is that there seems to be a correlation, an anti-correlation between the mass of the star and how many planets are orbiting it. The other thing I thought was interesting was Sarah Seeger getting up and saying, we may find life on an exoplanet within a week, and at most a few years. We're going to find it really soon. And it's like, oh, I can't believe what I'm hearing here. That's what motivated me to go talk to her privately, and that's another story. But this incredible optimism, and I remember back in 1995 when astronomers had found the first planets orbiting nuclear-burning stars, and they were saying, we're going to find all kinds of planets just like the planets in our solar system. Well, now the list is approaching 3,700 discovered exoplanets. None of them are like any of the planets in our solar system. And it's like this TRAPPIST-1 system, we know they're bone dry, and yet they're talking about them being in the water habitable zone. So that threw me. I also was stunned, Fuzz, to hear somebody speculating that the precursor to RNA and DNA was TNA. And it's like, we heard that back in 1999.
What's TNA?
Nucleic acids.
Oh, okay. I hadn't heard that term.
Well, it's all based on the fact that it doesn't look like there's any possible hope that you could get a naturalistic explanation for the origin of RNA or DNA. And so what they're speculating, well, maybe something chemically easier, like TNA, is a precursor. So you get TNA, and somehow it evolves into RNA and DNA.
So the RNA world hypothesis, that's not a...
No, it's still in vogue, but it's a pre-RNA world that gives rise to the RNA world that, again, gives rise to the DNA protein world. And the paper that was being presented was maybe the pre-RNA world and the RNA world kind of evolved in a simultaneous manner. So there was more of a... Instead of it being linear, it was more intertwined.
So I know you still have to weigh in, but that raises another question that I was hoping to ask a little bit earlier. You know, out of the three different origin of life scenarios, RNA world or metabolism first or replicative systems?
Lipid first.
Was there a discussion or a sense of one of those sort of winning the day today, or is it all just sort of...
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, the RNA world is still the leading idea, even though it's just beleaguered with all kinds of problems. And there's two reasons for that. One is it's the only way around the chicken and egg paradox, because DNA and proteins are interdependent on each other. And the only way to escape that is to have RNA molecules that are simultaneously information bearing and catalytic.
Right.
And so you can't escape the chicken and egg problem without some kind of RNA world, even if you're arguing metabolism first or lipid world or membrane first. Ultimately, they still have to have an RNA world in those scenarios. Also, people would argue that because RNA plays an intermediary role in biochemistry today, messenger RNA, the ribosomes are RNA, where in fact the catalytic portion of a ribosome is a ribozyme, because of tRNAs, the thought is that those are all molecular fossils representing that transition from the RNA world to the DNA protein world. So those are the two reasons why people are convinced it has to be an RNA world, though it's completely beleaguered with problems.
What about clays?
Oh, very much a big discussion of the role of minerals in the origin of life. Nothing that to me seemed outstanding one way or the other, but a nod that clays and other minerals do give you catalytic surfaces. They help to sequester materials. They might play a role in maybe generating chiral enrichment and help solve the homochirality problem, but nothing seemed to be overly compelling other than really speculation.
That was the other question I wanted to ask, was what did Blackmond have to say about sort of the status of homochirality and solving
She actually didn't present anything there. I mean, you know, what's interesting is, as you bring this up, is the something that struck me is, and Hugh and I talked about this, absolutely no real progress between 2002 and 2017.
Right.
The same papers were being presented today or last week as they were in 2002. It's the same.
What do you mean by same papers?
I mean, literally, the same questions were being asked.
The same abstracts read virtually the same.
The really? Same experiments being performed, the same struggle with how to interpret the results, the same, you know, frustrations. You could have taken anything from 2002 and presented it this year, and it would have not been out of place. You wouldn't have even noticed the difference.
So nothing cutting edge about
it. You could have
no
taken
breakthroughs.
Some stuff.
Well, the one cutting edge thing I saw that caught my attention was, I forget the name, but a guy got up and said, you know, we got to solve the ribose problem. You're not going to get RNA and DNA without the sugars to connect the nucleobases. And so we have to have borate to have any hope of making ribose. And so we talked about, you know, they struggled to try to show that there was actual borate in the crust of the earth at that time. But he wasn't a mineralogist. And then Robert Hazen, who is a real mineralogist, probably one of the top mineralogists in the world, got up and said, there's no way there's borate on the face of the earth. If you have any boron, it's going to become tourmaline. And once it becomes tourmaline, it'll be completely unavailable for any of this chemistry. But then he made an interesting comment. Of course, the origin of life happened, so somehow there's got to be borate. I just know from my mineralogy it doesn't work, but somehow it's got to work.
So I can't remember the guy's name. Last name might be Callahan, but this he writes sort of in the astrobiology arena and the meteorite arena and what can be done from meteoritic dust. And I know there was at least one publication in the last couple of years that looks at sort of starting with meteorite-type dust. And it's a laboratory experiment, right? And it's sort of bombarding, and I think with high energy protons, and in the presence of, I forget, formaldehyde or ammonia or something like that, they were able to generate ribose and many of the biologically relevant amino acids. And so, I mean, to me, that's the most interesting thing I've read in the past year.
I mean,
or two.
The thing is, it's not a problem to generate ribose or amino acids or what have you. The question is, will those processes actually happen on the conditions of the early Earth or in a extraterrestrial environment? In other words, this was actually something that I think really merits some discussion. In my book, Creating Life in the Lab, I basically identify three goals that Origin of Life researchers have when they do these experiments. The first is the chemistry even possible, or the physics possible? The second is, what is the mechanism for that chemistry or physics? And then the third is it geochemically relevant? And what you saw for at least 4 days of the conference when they talked about prebiotic chemistry to LUCA, that whole sequence of events, is basically it was the same cadence. Well, here's a particular scenario for the origin of life. In that scenario, these are some of the steps that would have to happen. If this particular step, one of these steps happens, it requires this kind of chemistry. Is that chemistry possible? Let's go in the lab and see if it's possible. So you concoct a model system and you say, oh, that chemistry is possible. And now let's study the bejesus out of this thing to learn the mechanisms. And it's just incredible state-of-the-art, top-notch science that is represented. And so what they conclude is the chemistry or physics is possible in principle. We understand the mechanisms. Therefore, it means that this is conceivable or possible in terms of chemical evolution. But nobody goes the next step and says, what happens when you translate it to the early Earth? And as soon as you make that attempt, you can just sit there with the back of an envelope and identify all the problems that inhibit that process from happening. So, for example, you can make lipid vesicles in the lab till the cows come home from fatty acids, and you can encapsulate stuff in them through a freeze or evaporation rehydration process. You can do all kinds of cool things with these vesicles. They'll grow, they'll fissure. They mimic cellular reproduction of sorts. But the problem is, all that happens in fresh water in the lab. As soon as you got even a little bit of salt, nothing happens. It frustrates everything. Well, the early Earth's oceans would have been at very high salt levels. So just from that elegant proof of principle set of experiments, mm-hmm. as soon as you try to translate it to the conditions of the early Earth, you've got big problems because the conditions just simply make that chemistry impossible. So that, you know, and
do they acknowledge this at all?
Yes, they do. You know, to me, you know, as Hugh was mentioning, these scientists are very pessimistic, which is true about the prospects of discovering the origin of life. But on the other hand, they're the most fun group of people to hang around with because though they're pessimistic, they are so enthusiastic about what they're doing as researchers. And I realized that most scientists love to solve problems, and that's what attracts them to science. But as part of that love for solving problems is actually solving the problem and getting the answer. Mm-hmm. Original life researchers don't care if they solve the problem. What they care about is actually working on the problem. Mm-hmm. For them, it's not the destination, it's the journey. And mm-hmm. they just seem to revel in the fact that there's all these open-ended questions. This is such a difficult problem. We have no clue what to do. We can speculate till the cows come home. They are so imaginative. They're so creative. And they're so enthusiastic about what they're doing that it doesn't seem to matter to them that they can't solve this problem, because the problem itself, the puzzle itself, is what's a lot of fun to work. And so it's just a very different breed of scientists, but they're a lot of fun to hang around with.
Well, they're also convinced that there's got to be a solution, because they say, we know the origin of life happened. We know there is no God, so it's got to be a naturalistic pathway. We just haven't found it yet.
Yes. Mm.
And so that's what opened up a lot of conversations for us. If you guys ever considered a different kind of model. But let me add one more thing, and that's from astronomy, is that I heard a lot of chemistry about we really can make ribose in the chemistry that we know that operates inside interstellar molecular clouds. Because, you know, they're the foremost reaction is working, and we're going to have boron there so we can get the borate that works. But what they're not taking into account is, yeah, the conditions exist there in interstellar molecular clouds, but when we astronomers have actually tried to find ribose, we find nothing. Even in the densest molecular clouds we observe, we see zero. And if you go back to the lab chemistry, what you realize, yes, you can make ribose, but guess what? The same conditions that exist in interstellar molecular clouds destroy the ribose. And so, yeah, you're going to get ribose, but it's probably going to be the level of one part per billion. And when it is that dilute, it's of no value at all to any origin of life research model.
These raw materials that we spoke of a little earlier that we think maybe, or some suggest, came, how were they made on the Earth? Presumably...
They're made inside living cells.
Well, yeah. Not the raw materials.
Well, like the ribose.
I meant these basic.
Oh, like hydrogen cyanide, right. and things like that. I mean, right. There are abiotic processes that will generate those materials.
So they'll be made here on the Earth over millions and billions of.
Yeah, I mean, there are mechanisms today on the Earth that will generate those kind of materials abiotically.
Right.
But
they weren't present. To begin with,
no. I mean, what we would have present on the early Earth would be potentially hydrogen, ammonia, methane, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide. Those would probably not oxygen. Those would be the kinds of inventory of gaseous materials. Maybe some hydrogen cyanide, sulfur dioxide, sulfur monoxide. Nitrous oxide, those would be the kinds
of... So isn't there trace oxygen present in the models because of, like, hydrolysis and things like
this?
Yes. Okay.
Yes, right. Yes.
But these raw materials were not of sufficient quantity to...
So, yeah, you would have these gaseous materials, and there clearly are processes that would have existed on the early Earth that could have produced, you know, hydrogen cyanide and formaldehyde and things like that. But the question is... you know, are you producing these things at high enough levels
to
facilitate the origin of life?
Right.
What would the steady state levels be? Right. You know, on the
okay.
There was a lot more attention in 2002 on the lifetimes of different amino acids and nucleobases and sugars. Mm-hmm. Maybe you heard some of that on Friday, but
nope.
I didn't hear any of this. But again, what I saw was some amazing chemistry experiments. And Joe, what I especially liked about this conference, and I think you commented on this too, is that a lot more opportunity for individual interaction. Mm-hmm. We weren't just sitting in chairs looking at a, because they would, you know, we would sit around tables for lunch and dinner. And so then there was a walking distance between the apartments we were staying at and the actual lecture hall. So unlike 1999 and 2002, Fuzz and I had a lot of opportunities to talk to people. I think we've made a difference too, Fuzz. Back in 2002, we didn't have a book on the origins of life. We had a few articles, that was it. But the fact that we had a book and that the book was reviewed by David Deamer, that suddenly people were saying, well, we want to talk to you guys. Mm-hmm. So
what would be your kind of overall summary then coming away from this thing?
I think there's, you know, a lot of interesting work happening in original life research. There's a lot of really good science, but that science isn't really leading to any kind of insight that is truly providing progress towards explaining the origin of life through evolutionary means. You know, you do see, I think, some work that's happening in synthetic biology and original life research that actually will have, I believe, biotechnology applications. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's turning into a research program that does have practical utility and practical benefit. But I see in 15 years, when we go to the next one at UCSD, basically seeing the same kind of papers being presented, where I don't really see any kind of genuine insight or progress really happening.
So no, we're not going to find life on an exoplanet in the next day or two?
I don't think so. But I think what was kind of a stunner for several of the attendees, this generates some conversations I had, was Robert Hazen getting up and saying, Mars only has 100 minerals. Earth has 5,200.
Yeah. Well,
we have those 5,200 minerals because of life. But the conversations I was having is, if we only got 100 minerals without life, then we're really in big trouble, because they're assuming there's going to be this rich repository of minerals, and they weren't taking into account we have that on Earth because Earth has had such prolific life for such a long period of time.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
And actually, even when you get life, it goes from 100 to 250, then it goes up to 500. It really doesn't become the thousands until you get to the Cambrian explosion.
Hmm.
I want you guys to comment on what you told the staff the other day about this term atheist by default, because you had some good interactions with a number of the scientists there around the tables. Can you comment on that?
Well, they would find out that we're Christians, and you know, right away they were suspicious, saying, well, are you Christians like those people in the young Earth community or the intelligent design community? And we had to explain why we're different. You know, we build our case on a testable creation model. They were impressed that we have both done postdoctoral studies on secular university campuses, and that our book actually got reviewed by David Deamer.
And he is who?
He's one of the world's leading origin of life researchers. And, you know, he was the one that contacted us after we came up with the book Origins of Life. Do you mind if I do a critical review for the journal Origins of Life and the Evolution of the Biosphere? And we encouraged him to go ahead. And what he published was quite a positive review. So, I mean, this opened up conversations for us. And they said, well, you know, this is unusual. You guys are Christians at this conference. And then they would just say, well, you know, I'm an atheist. But when we began to talk to them, we discovered they're simply default atheists. They've never really thought through what atheism means. And it's interesting having conversations with these scientists. It's like, have you ever thought about the fact that your life is going to end and you're going to die? No, that's never occurred to me. And, well, you know, that might have implications that you should think about. And again, it exposes the problem with a lot of research scientists. They're having so much fun doing their research. their research distracts them from the most important issues of life. But I think, Fuzz, what we discovered is once we brought the subject up, they wanted to talk.
Yep.
In fact, there was this one astronomer that actually followed us all the way back to our apartment because she wanted to continue the conversation, and we couldn't even get out of the elevator because she wanted to keep the conversation going.
Wow.
And so it's like she's always labeled herself an atheist, but the truth is it's basically they're saying, I'm a scientist, I guess I must be an atheist. And so there's a mission field there. We need to be engaging these scientists and actually begin to ask them questions that will help them to develop a real world view.
But, you know, I think the key to why there was so much openness to discuss these kind of science faith issues, and it was remarkable to me, there wasn't a single person in which we had these conversations where they reacted with hostility or they didn't seem to be interested or ask follow-up questions. There wasn't even a single...
Even the European scientists were very receptive to it.
Yes, yeah. So. And you could tell they had a very simplistic view of the relationship between science and faith, in addition to being default atheists, as Hugh points out. But I think the key is they were impressed that Hugh and I were at the conference, that we were trying to understand what they were doing, that we understood what they were doing, we understood the science, we could engage them at a technical level, which revealed to them that we knew what we were talking about. But I think this really highlights the fact that it's very important for us as Christians when we approach scientists and we want to have spiritual conversations that we've done our homework. And I'm not saying that lay people have to suddenly become experts in every discipline of science, but you need to do enough of your homework that you actually understand the ideas that they're being presented by the scientific community, the rationale for those ideas, what motivates the researchers, that we're not mischaracterizing the work. And sadly, for me, much of what I see when it comes to Christian apologetics with respect to the origin of life question represents a gross misrepresentation of what's actually going on in origin of life research communities. What I heard being presented that past week is nothing like what I see Christian apologists discussing or representing when it comes to the origin of life question. And in fact, some of the more common popular arguments that are presented against the origin of life are utter straw man arguments. And that creates distrust, frustration, and dismissal on the part of these scientists. And people confuse that with basically being hard-hearted extreme atheism when in fact, they're just simply dismissing you because it's evident to them you don't know what you're talking about, and it's not worth...
You haven't taken the time to understand our position.
Yeah, we had to first persuade them that we're not like those other Christians. So
the point is, if you want to approach, let's say, an origin of life researcher and you're a lay person, instead of spouting off some kind of challenge to chemical evolution, maybe you ought to sit down and get to know that person, ask them about their research, and ask them, where do you see difficulties? They were very quick to point out where they thought there were problems, and they would agree with our critiques where they thought where we thought the problems were. They would agree, and they were happy to talk about the implications of that a little bit. And so they weren't immune to acknowledging the difficulties or the shortcomings with the model, but they did it because it was evident to them that we wanted to understand their perspective on these things. And so if you ask questions and even challenging questions to these scientists, they love to talk about those things and they will admit where there's shortcomings. And that's where you can have, I think, real productive conversations introducing the Christian faith and the idea of intelligent design and creationism. It's not that they're hostile to those ideas or hostile to poorly conceived scientific arguments.
Well, the other thing is they were asking us why we're not in academia. And that gave us an opportunity to say, well, we were in academia, but leaving academia has now given us the opportunity to integrate across many different disciplines. And yeah, what we saw over and over again, Fuzz, is that they were aware of a difficulty in their subdiscipline, but had no idea that it was ubiquitous across all the disciplines. And I saw them very eager to listen to us saying, well, you know, if you actually look at the chemistry, integrated what we know coming from geophysics and astronomy and what we know about biology, they're all ears. So, you know, we'd never really thought that through.
Mm-hmm. All right. Great stuff. Any last comments? Otherwise, that's a good place to leave it off. Where's it going to be next time? 3 years hence, right?
I don't know.
Did they say?
Well, they usually announce it at the gala dinner on Thursday night, but neither Hugh and I went because it costs $50, and we wanted to be good stewards of the ministry's money, so we didn't go to the gala dinner.
Wow, $50. What were they serving? Prime rib and lobster?
No, I think it was wieners and beans.
Yeah, rubber chicken.
But we can go on their website and find out. But what's made it difficult for us to attend their meetings is they love to hold them in exotic places. Mm. And it's like, you know, they got NASA travel grants that will pay all our expenses. So we don't have that luxury.
That's right.
So,
okay. Well, we are certainly glad that both of you went. And now you as a listener have been brought up to speed on the latest from ISOL 2017. Thanks, Hugh and Fuzz, and AJ and Dave for your contributions as well. Joe Aguirre, I learned a lot. And now you as a listener have benefited as well. Thanks for listening.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.